Please turn off your beepers and cell phones. Do not bring any beverages or food into the church. Refreshments must remain in the Duke Room. My name is Tara, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary purpose is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Bonnie will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Bonnie. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Jonathan will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Jonathan. I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, make a direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to make personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Stuart will read the traditions.
Stuart, alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each AA group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Alan L.
Thanks. Alan, alcoholic. Oh, hi, everyone. I am definitely a member of this group. My sobriety date is March 9, 2002. My sponsor's Ron. And I'm currently working all the steps. I'm just going to tell you what it was like, what it's like now, and how I got here. I was born April 5th, 1972, to Puerto Rican parents in New York City. I started, my first 2 years of life were in the Bronx. Then I moved to Puerto Rico briefly. Don't remember much about it, except I remember I caught my first resentment when I moved back to New York because I had a puppy that they wouldn't let me bring back. And I didn't talk to my mother for like a month when I got back to New York. Everything was normal up until about the age of 12. That's when my mother got pregnant with my little brother, and my father, he had decided that he didn't want my mother to have this child, so he walked out on us. And my mother's a hairdresser, and when her stomach started to get big, she could no longer work. So it was very traumatic to go from having two parents and everything to a mother who had to go on public assistance to support me and my sister while she was pregnant, and the father that kind of just left. So I turned to the streets for adult guidance. My father wasn't around. And needless to say, the guys in my neighborhood, they weren't the best bunch of guys. They were like, you know, street guys. And through them, I started indulging in dry goods. I didn't touch alcohol till I was 14. And at the age of 14, I was at a party, and there was a girl there that I had a major crush on. And there was no dry goods at this party that night, but they had alcohol. And I knew that alcohol, you know, got you drunk. So I asked the girl to, I didn't know anything about alcohol except one thing, a screwdriver. I remembered that it was orange juice and vodka. So I asked the girl who was running the party to give me a screwdriver. She gave me one. I drank it. I started to feel that feeling, that wonderful, free feeling. Like, I don't care what other people think. I asked for another one, then another one, then another one, until I was completely passed out, threw up all over the girl that I liked, and just made a complete and total fool of myself. But needless to say, I didn't drink again after that for a little while. I picked up alcohol again at 17, but between the ages of 14 and 17, I was still indulging in dry goods. I got in trouble with the law, and I started to go away to homes and stuff. And finally, after like 20 months being away from home in a group home, I got out and decided I'm going to put everything down and I'm going to go to school and try and live a normal teenage life. And I did that for a little while, but I didn't have any kind of program. So eventually, I started going to clubs and I discovered the club scene. That became my new high, the club scene. But I discovered in the clubs when people were dancing, I would feel awkward dancing with them. I was always in my head about dancing. So I decided to pick up alcohol again. And I started drinking when I started going out to clubs, and it was like, when I drank, I didn't care what other people thought, I could talk to the girls, and it was, and I loved it. But eventually, the drinking brought me back to the dry goods, and I started to combine the two. And it created a cycle of insanity where I just like gave up on life. I left high school and everything, and I was drinking round the clock. And my parents were like, you can't live here. So I became homeless, and I was on the street hanging out with the wrong people. And eventually, I started to commit crimes to support my drinking and my dry good habit. And at the age of 20, I was on the street committing robberies, and I finally got caught. And needless to say, I had been arrested many times before, but it was always like for 2 days, you know, it was nothing major, but I got caught this time for 6 counts of armed robbery. And when I got arrested, it was in a high-speed car chase. I had all the stuff that I had taken from the people in the car, so I knew I was going away for a while. And I ended up getting sentenced to 5.5 to 16.5 years in prison. Yeah, it was like that. I really couldn't believe what was happening to me. Looking back on it now, it is the best thing that happened to me, because if I didn't get arrested, I would have been dead. The drinking, dry good use, I was just crazy. And I got to tell you, prison, it's not as bad as people think it is. I mean, Really, I met some great people in there. You know, one of my best friends now is he's the manager of a steakhouse. We did time together. You probably have eaten there, but I'll keep his anonymity in check. I went to jail, and I was scared at first. I was very frightened, you know. Here I am, 20 years old, you know, cute kid. Didn't really, like, come from a bad family. The family's great. But I had to put on an act to survive. And I knew that if I didn't assimilate, that they were going to eat me alive. So for 5.5 years, I put on this thuggish comedian act, and I got through the time. But jail is just like the street. There's drugs there, there's alcohol there, and I didn't address my issues. So when I got out 6.5 years later, I was not ready for society. I went right back after 90 days. And it's funny because I bumped into my current sponsor when I went back. I went into the Tombs 90 days after being released, after doing 6.5 years. I knew I had to change, that something had to give. So I went to an AA meeting in prison in the Tombs, and Ron Black was speaking there that day. And I went back up for a year. I did meetings in prison. I came home, and the first guy I saw at a meeting was Ron Black, a year later. But he wasn't my sponsor. I kind of didn't know anything about sponsorship. I walked into AG after doing 7 years, and I got to tell you, I was just mortified by all the success I saw and all the beautiful people. And what kept me coming back was the women. Because I had not had sex in 8 years, and I was just like, I was thirsty. I was thirsty. I chased this one girl around for months, and I had nothing to offer. My sponsor time used to always tell me, what do you have to offer? You know, nothing. Nothing. Do the steps. And then. By the way, Vince became my sponsor because I walked into a beginner's meeting, and him and his wife were chairing it. And I had been approached by people in AG before him, and one guy came up to me and was like, hey, you knew it. We work a strict program of recovery. And I was like, whoa, beat it. Like, I don't even know. You know, I just out of prison. What do you want from my life? But Vince had that gangster thing about him, and I used to eat with these people upstate, you know what I mean? And I said, this guy's going to be my sponsor. And he started taking me through the steps, and he did a great job. I just... You know, after 2.5 years of being out of prison, I started to get a really good life, and I started to forget where I came from. So I had 1 foot in the door of AA and 1 foot out. I was doing the steps, but I wasn't really listening. I wasn't doing all this, taking all the suggestions. And in 2002, after starting a career, I became a trainer, and I was working at Bloomingdale selling fragrance, and I had this gorgeous girlfriend. I thought, AA can go to the back end of the burner. And before you know it, I got arrested on a relapse in Queens and went back to jail. As I was a member of this group at the time. And so, I can't describe the feelings of being back in prison after being exposed to this life. You know what I mean? After getting all the things I had. And I cried every day for 90 days while I was there. But you know what? It was just what God had in store for me. Because if I didn't go back, I would have never got sober. I came out. I went right back to Vince, and I said, I'm ready, dude. I'm ready to work this program the right way. And he took me through the steps again, and I've been sober ever since. And that was 5 years ago. So I'm very happy today. I'm extremely happy. I'm a makeup artist now. Can you imagine ex-con makeup artist? Only in AA. You got people asking me to do their makeup at their weddings. I'm like, sure, no problem. You sure about that? Anyway. I love this group. I've been here since 2000. I've seen many people come and go. I've seen people that will never leave, I think. And I hope I'm one of those. How much time do I have left? I have 1.5 minutes. Okay, the steps. Very important. Let's talk about the steps a little bit. Somebody told me to speak to the newcomer, but I'm not, I hope there's people, I hope, you know, I'm talking to everyone. I'm talking to anyone who's here who has time, that is struggling, you know what I mean, that... If you're struggling, open up that book, get with a sponsor who's done the steps, who knows what he's talking about, start working those steps, and your life will change. It wasn't until I started working the steps the way it's outlined in the book and praying to God and doing all the things suggested to me that my life got better. And because I did that, I'm standing up here today off parole. Just got off parole a month ago. I'll be celebrating my 35th birthday on Thursday. I never thought I would make it to 35. I'm happy. I love everyone, and have a great night.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Anna.
Hi, I'm Anna. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date's November 14th, 2005. My sponsor's name is Tika. My home group's the Atlanta Group. And I'm working on step 9 and living in 10, 11, and 12. It's really good to be here. It's always, like, probably my favorite place in the world is to be in an AA meeting. And I definitely never, ever thought that I would say that. But all the things in my life today that I get the most out of are things I never thought would have been. So I grew up in LA. I always drank. My sister was just like sending me baby pictures of us, and one of them was like me, like with a beer, and I was like two, this like fat like toddler with like a beer, and like this 2-year-old's like completely obsessed with like the beer. Like all the other kids are like playing with each other, and I'm just like completely like looking at it. And that's kind of like how my drinking was. Like any time that alcohol was in the picture, like any other thing was like just not a priority at all. Like any boy, any like project, anything that I thought would, like, make me happy and, like, matter in my life. Like, as soon as I started drinking was, like, my priority. Where I grew up, like, all my friends drank just as much as I did. They got into trouble just as much as I did. All my friends were going to rehab at young ages, so, like, nothing was ever a problem because I wasn't the worst at all. I would push the limits and, like, break all the rules and, like, you know, I would get into, like, small, you know, like, as much trouble as you can get into when, like, you grow up, like, without rules. Like, I never had a curfew or anything, so. But, like, you know, I never had a curfew, but I still managed to, like, get grounded. I was, like, the only kid in my family who could, like, get grounded. And, you know, I hated LA. I was so miserable there, and I, you know, thought that it was everyone around me. I thought it was all my friends, and I thought it was, like, my circumstances. And so I was like, you know, oh, college, like, this will be the best opportunity to get out. And so I had a list of, like, all, like, 10, 15 schools. They were all on the East Coast. And what happened was I woke up on, like, January 3rd from, like, a, like, you know, 3-day-long, like, drinking binge, and I realized I'd, like, completely forgotten to apply to every single college on my list, because the application date is, like, January 1st, which I don't really understand, like, why they make that, because that's, like, the day after New Year's. I guess the people, like, turn it in early, but, like, that didn't occur to me. So, you know, so what happened was, like, the school I go to now, like, their application date was, like, the January 15th, and so I, you know, luckily, like, I applied there, and it was the only school I applied to, and, like, I got in, and it's a really good school, and, like, I completely love it. Like, obviously, like, my higher power had a plan for me, but people always ask me, they're like, you know, why did you pick this school? And I can make up any number of reasons, because it's a really good school, but really, it's because I was too drunk to apply anywhere else. And so, you know, I got to this new school, and I was finally happy, and I had, like, all these friends, and I had, you know, this amazing opportunity in front of me. And I made a really stupid decision, and I realized in sobriety that the day I made that really stupid decision, I took tequila shots in the morning, and I got suspended from school. And so this was just, like, the worst thing ever. I had to go back to LA, and I remember it was this whole long thing, because I had, like, a 4.0 when I got suspended, and everyone, like, was really confused as to, like, how I could get into so much trouble and still, like, you know, seem like a perfect student. And it was this whole long ordeal. Like, I wasn't allowed in any of the dorms or anywhere on campus except for class, and I had to, like, move to this, like, weird, like, hotel, like, dorm thing. And I remember, like, my dad called me, and he, you know, moved out of the country, and so I had, like, this huge resentment against him. So I was like, I really don't even want to hear anything you have to say. And he's like, I don't understand, like, are you just drunk, like, the whole time that you're, like, I don't understand how you could do this, like, are you just drunk the whole time? And I was like, no. And I realized, I was like, yes, like, I am. And so I had this, like, you know, like, self-knowledge that I was like, oh my god, like, drinking's my problem, like, I'm gonna stop. So I did, and I was completely miserable and, like really seriously depressed. Like, you know, I mean, granted, like, I had just lost this huge opportunity, so it made sense that I was depressed, but, you know, I had to go back home, and I would just be, like, driving, and, like, a song would come on the radio, and I would just start, like, crying. Like, it was so bad. I couldn't do anything, and it was because I was, you know, it was probably the first time in, like, 6 years that I wasn't, you know, drinking all the time. So I got a job, and I, you know, started to do really well, and I started to drink again. You know, I thought it was fine that now I was drinking with adults, and, you know, like, things would be different. And I, you know, again, like, drinking became my priority, and all my rules that I ever had, I always said, you know, I would never drive drunk because, you know, there were so many instances of, like, death in my high school where kids drove drunk. And all of a sudden, like, I would be driving drunk. And, you know, I hit so many bottoms in that year that I was like, you know, I really just need to stop. And I got back into school, and I would just be like, I'm not going to drink. Like, this time's going to be different. Like, two girls in my school had just died. And I was like, you know, that could have been me. Like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I would go out to parties and I'd be like, you know, I'm not going to drink tonight. And I would, like, you know, an hour later have a drink in my hand. And I would, like, tell people I was Muslim. And I would, like, you know, tell people that I was allergic to alcohol. And I wanted someone else to tell me I was allergic to alcohol. Like, I wanted just, like, you know, someone to just be like, you can't drink, and to, like, hold my hands down. And I would just always end up drink. And I started to just get, like, you know, really violently sick, and, like, it didn't matter. Like, I still kept drinking. And one weekend, my friend came to visit me, and, like, I started drinking before he even came. Like, he came on Friday night, and I, like, started drinking in the day, and then he left on Sunday, and, like, I kept drinking. I drank everything that was left in my apartment. And the next morning, I was, like, on the street with, like, a random acquaintance, and there was, like, this, like, awkward, like, lull in the conversation, and I was like, I really need to get sober. And as I said it, I was like, where did that come from? Like, I have no idea. And I've heard someone share about it. It's, like, the record skips, and that's, like, when your higher power steps in. And I honestly believe that's what happened, because she looked at me dead in the eye, and she's like, go to an AA meeting. And I was like, okay. And people had said that to me before, and I was, like, never willing to listen. And so she hooked me up with a friend, and he took me to this meeting Tuesday night, and I came, and I, like, remember I met Jared outside, and he's like, how many days sober do you have? And I was like, I have no idea. And so we figured it out, and I had 2 days, and then these, like, group of women, like, pulled me, and they were like, women with the women, like, stick with us. And I was just, like, so confused and out of it. And then it was, like, the point where, you know, that's about to happen, where everyone, like, raises their hand and says their day count. And these women, like, shoved me up, and I was like, hi, I'm Anna, like, I'm an alcoholic, and I have 2 days. And, like, I've never had a sentence feel so right. And, you know, I was really out of it. Like, my first, like, 90 days of sobriety, I was, like, so out of it. And I remember, like, I was in this church, like, with 10 days or something. I remember, like, looking up at this, like, Jesus and being like, where am I? Like, sort of, like, coming out of, like, a cloud. But, you know, but then I thought to myself, I was like, you know, I've consistently felt like I was in the right place at the right time. And so I just kept coming, and I got a sponsor, Tika, and she started to take me through the book. And then right when I got 90 days, she was like, you know, every meeting that you go to, talk to a newcomer, get their number and call them the next day. And, like, at first it didn't go so well. I would, like, offer people my number and they'd be like, no, thank you. But, you know, like, I just like, sort of, like, kept coming and, like, kept doing it. And, you know, and right around, like, 9 months, I hit, like, this, like, bottom in sobriety where it was, like, really bad, and I got really depressed, and I just, you know, I had a therapist, and she was like, you know, you should go on antidepressants, and no one had ever said that to me before, and I was like, you know, I'm really just gonna try to, like, throw myself into this program, and, that's what I did. I started making, like, 10 meetings a week, and, like, just really, like, you know, I called 10 people a day. I was just, like, always fellowshipping, and, like, you know, always just, like, I just completely, like, every ounce of my energy, like, threw into this program because I didn't know where else to turn at all. And you know, and it was working, you know, like, I stayed sober, and, like, I was, you know, I felt fine when I was doing service, and then as soon as, like, a newcomer would, like, leave my side, I would feel horrible again. And I was praying so much. I was praying, like, 10 times a day, and I had this experience where I was just, like, on my knees and praying and just being like, I don't feel anything. And I prayed that. I said, I was like, you know, God, I don't believe in you. And, you know, and I just sort of, like, said the prayers, and I just started talking honestly with God, and I just, you know, people talk about, like, this God-sized hole that we have that we try to, like, fill with other things, and I felt, like, I literally felt, like, a hole inside me. Like, I just didn't feel, like, spiritual or, like, what any, you know, what other people had, and I remember, like, qualifying and being, like, thinking inside, like, I feel like a fraud. Like, I'm sober today, but I don't feel that, like, you know, spiritual experience, and, you know, I just kept putting, like, baby steps, like, one foot in front of the other. Like, I didn't know what to do on, like, the grand scheme of things, but I knew, like, oh, like, it's 12 o'clock. A meeting starts at 12:30, and I could do that. Or, like, oh, like, it's 11 o'clock. Like, I can call a newcomer today. And I would just do, like, baby steps, like, one foot in front of the other. And I heard someone say, like, you know, we're in the business of action, and God's in the business of results. And so I just kept doing that, like, one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. And, you know, and now, like, I do feel it. Like, I don't feel that, like, hole anymore. Like, I really do feel, like, content to, like, be present in my life. And that's just, like, the most amazing gift ever. So, you know, if you're new, just sort of, like, hang on to your seat. And, like everyone says, don't quit before the miracle happens. Thanks.
Okay, our main speaker tonight is Barry.
Good evening, my name is Barry, I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here, it's good to be sober. My home group is Serenity by the Sea PM, Point Lookout. My last drink was October the 21st, 1991. Might have been the 22nd, it could have been the 23rd. Might even be in September, I don't know, but anyway. Jeez Louise, I bet you divorce lawyers do well in this group, huh? You got a kind of an international flavor going tonight. You have I was born in Ireland. And I grew up in a small little town, you know, 4,000 people. And from a very young age, I made a promise to myself that I would never drink. Never, ever drink. Because I saw the destruction that alcohol did. You know, every time there was a raised voice, every time there was an argument in the house, there was alcohol involved. You know, so I saw my father, who was a loving, caring man when he wasn't drinking, become this Jekyll and Hyde character when he was drinking. And when he drank, that's the man I didn't want to be. I wanted to be him when he wasn't drinking, and I didn't want to be him when he was drinking. You know. So I made that promise to myself when I was a young kid that I would never drink. Now, as a young kid, I went everywhere with my father. He was at work, I was at work with him. He was home, I was home. He went to the gin mill, I was at the gin mill. You know, I was sitting on his lap, drinking out of his big pint glass, at an early age. And I remember getting the attention of all the older men who drank with him. I'd have a little mustache with Guinness on the top of it, and they all thought it was great. Never liked the taste of alcohol, but I absolutely loved what alcohol did for me, because it took me from a wallflower to the middle of the dance floor, and that's what I loved about alcohol. And I discovered that for the first time when I was about 12 years old. I was at a school dance, and up to this point I would see girls go up and down to school. I'd see them at school, you know. I couldn't talk to them. I didn't have the courage to talk to them. I go to this one dance with some friends of mine, and I have, I can remember as clear as day, 2 pints of Carling Black Label Lager. And I drank 1.5 of them. Left the gin mill, went across the street to the dance hall, and the minute I walked in the door, I was in the middle of the dance floor. And I realized that alcohol did that for me. I said, this stuff is wonderful. And I used it as best I could for as long as I could from that point on. You know, that took me, it made me from a wallflower to John Travolta in a glass, you know. I went from Pee Wee Herman to John Wayne, all in one swoop. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. So it afforded me to do and say stuff I could normally only dream of. And that's what alcohol did for me. Big fear of failing. So at 13 or 14, my parents were going through a split. They separated for a while. And I used that to my advantage, you know. I wanted to leave school, and that's exactly what I did. I manipulated my parents because I had them at a weak moment, and that's what I did. I used it to my advantage because, I knew they weren't thinking about my education, you know. So I went to my father in a drunken state. He was in a drunken state. I wasn't in a drunken state. And I asked him, could I leave school? He said, sure, you can. So then I went to my mother, who was living with a friend of hers at the time, and I manipulated my way into letting her leave me school. And she left me leave school. So at 14, a part-time job became a full-time job. I would work 6 days a week, 2, 3, 4 nights a week. I'd get paid on a Saturday, and I'd have to borrow money on a Monday or a Sunday sometimes. At 14 years of age. And life was good. Because the guys that I hung around with, we all drank the same. Every one of us. You know, if you didn't drink, we didn't want to know you. And that was the bottom line. We would sit in a gin mill on a Sunday afternoon in Ireland, with the sun splitting the stones on the rare occasion that the sun did shine in Ireland, if it wasn't raining. And we would dream about, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, but we're going to have a drink first. By the time we got around to do anything, the sun was gone down, and we were drunk once again. And that was our lives, you know. We went to work, and we drank. We worked hard, we played hard. And you measured a man by how much money he had in his pocket and how much he could drink. This is the mentality I grew up with. Those are the tools that you were given. You know, how much can you drink and how much money do you have in your pocket? So that's what you try to achieve at 14 and 15 years of age. So I was off to a flying start, needless to say. I am, you know, 16, 17, 18, my drinking increased naturally, you know. If there was a long weekend, you know, if there was a holiday weekend, you drink all through the weekend. If you had money, you got up Monday morning and you went to the gin mill, you drank all day. And, you know, 20 pints, 24 pints of Carling Blackleg a Lager wasn't unusual at 17, 18 years of age. And then you got up Tuesday morning and you went to work. Because it was easier to go to work with a hangover than stay home and listen to your mother. Believe me when I tell you. So, at about 18 or 19, my friends started to, they started to immigrate. They went to England, they came to us, they came to America, they went to New Zealand, they went to Australia, they went to the four corners of the globe. I really had no desire to leave my small little town. I was very happy where I was because I was living at home. Meals were cooked, clothes were washed, the bed was made, and my girlfriend owned the gin mill. So all my needs were taken care of. So I had no great desire to leave. But to tell you what kind of person I am, it was easier for me to hop on a plane for the first time, come to America, pick up the phone and break off with a girl that I was dating for 3 years. It was easier for me to do that than do the manly thing and tell her, this isn't working out. It's time for us to part our ways. So that's what you do. You get drunk, you borrow a suitcase, you throw some crap in the suitcase, you hop on a plane for the first time and you come to America. I knew nothing. When I tell you I was clueless, I was clueless. My vision of America was the guys in the opening scene of Hawaii Five-O. I land at Kennedy Airport and I'm looking for these guys in a rowboat, you know. So I land at Kennedy Airport with a hangover. You know, you would think you would remember your first plane ride. I have no recollection of it whatsoever. Blackouts were a big part of my drinking. And I see people that I never saw before in my life. All descriptions, all shapes, all sizes. And the first thought that comes into my mind, like our big book says, I had arrived. I was going to do great things here. But the only problem with that statement was, I brought me with me. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was going to do great things here. But for me to do anything, I had to have a drink first. I had to have a drink first. My disease told me have a drink. My mind told me have a drink, and my body told me have more drinks. And that's exactly what happened. My buddy picks me up at Kennedy Airport, and we drive out to Baldwin, Long Island. We don't go to his place and drop the bag off. We go right to the gin mill. And we stay there till 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm getting ready to leave at 12 o'clock, because that's the time they close back home. And he says to me, where are you going? I said, don't we have to go home? He says, no, they close at 4 o'clock in the morning. And my next statement to him was, why didn't you tell me come here sooner? You know, my drinking took off. You know, it was bad enough when I was at home, I would get some shakes and some jitters. When I got to America, my drinking took off. The shakes got worse. The DTs got worse. I would see rats and snakes coming up the bed. I would see the devil coming out of the wall. I was bleeding from places you don't normally bleed from. And the insanity was, I would take my head out of the toilet bowl, flush away that last ounce of yellow-green stuff, and then I would say, dear God, just get me out of this one. Whether it be an hour, 2 hours, 4 hours later, I was back drinking again. After I had gone through what I just told you. But my disease told me, and I believed it, all that will stop if you have a couple of drinks. And it never lied to me. I would have a couple of drinks and it would stop. But the Indian sanity kicked in and I was off to the races one more time. And I would go through that vicious cycle and I would forget that vicious cycle. I wouldn't remember it. Because I would believe the lie that it's going to be different. Every time I went drinking, I believed the lie that it was going to be different. That I wasn't going to see the rats or the snakes. I wasn't going to see the devil coming out of the wall. And I believed it every time. My mind told me go drinking, and my body told me keep drinking. And that's exactly what I did. And I figured, if I reach to the age of 25, 30, I'll be doing great. I'll be in good shape. As long as I can go down drinking, I'll be okay. And that's all. That was the only achievement I ever wanted in my life. Live to be 30 and drink. That's all I wanted. I don't ask for much. Yeah, simple. I'm a simple kind of guy. And I figured if I get to that stage, the guys with the white coats, eventually the guys with the white coats are going to come, lock me up and throw away the key. Because I was going insane. I was insane a lot of time, and I figured I was going to go nuts. They'd come, lock me up, and I'd be done. You know? I'm living in Baldwin at this stage. I'm in a studio, I guess you could call it. It's a bachelor pad, and the stove doesn't work because it's clogged with filth and dirt. You know, there's little plastic cups filled with cigarette butts. The toilet bowl is backed up. You know, so it was attractive. There was I don't remember even if I had a bed. I think I had a mattress. I don't know if I had a bed or not. But the key was, and this was the selling point for this apartment of mine, across the street, closer from here to the back door, was a gin mill. There was one light in the place, unisex bathrooms. You walked in there, and the drink was up on the counter before you closed the door. And this was heaven. You know, when I look back on it now, there was guys at the time, they were literally dying. Literally dying. They would come in the morning, they wouldn't utter a word, wouldn't open their mouths to anybody, and they would just keep drinking all day long. And I was in heaven. There was a pool table, I believe. Yeah, there was a pool table and a jukebox. There was more life in the jukebox than there was sitting on the counter. You know, and the only one in the jukebox was Patsy Cline, and she was dead a long, long time. Yeah. So anyway, I figured I'm going to go insane. I'm in the horrors one night in my bachelor pad. And in a moment of sanity, I go to my landlady and I tell her what's happening. She says, you better go to the emergency room, go see a doctor. Don't die in my place, go someplace else. So I go to the emergency room. Doctor comes out. He asks me a couple of questions. You know, one of the questions he asked me, do you drink? No, don't drink. He said, okay. So he says, come with me. We go to the third floor of the hospital. He puts the key in a lock. We walk in and the door closes behind us. I said, that's it. Life is over. I'm done. I know now it was a psychiatric ward. You know, prior coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was probably the best 3 weeks of my life. And I'll tell you why. No bills, no bills to pay. Three meals a day, a shower in the room, and the guy I shared the room with, the other nut that I shared the room with, he was related to one of the ex-presidents of America. And I thought this was the greatest thing in the world. They give us arts and crafts, you know. He was asking for hands. We have, on the corridor, we have 10-pin bowling. Rubber pin and a rubber ball. That's, God forbid you should use the real stuff, you know, somebody might get injured. In the course of the 3 weeks, they hook you up to all sorts of tests and all sorts of machines, and the psychiatrist brings in his associate. He wants to do tests on you too. And at the end of 10 weeks, he says, "Mr. O'Reilly, we can't find anything wrong with you." That was a disappointment to me. I figured he's going to come back and tell me I'm crazy and I can go on drinking. Now, if I had been honest with him when he put me in there, he'd have known exactly what was wrong with me. You know, tell me I'm crazy, but don't tell me I'm an alcoholic. Because that's a terrible cross for anybody to carry around the place, to be an alcoholic. That's the last thing I wanted to hear. Knowing in my heart of hearts that I was an alcoholic. Not fully understanding it, but knowing there was something wrong with my drinking, you know. Because I was always swapping, changing, drink in the morning, drink at night, drink in the evening, changing drinks. The result was the same. Once my mind told me, go drink, my body kept telling me, keep pouring it in. Feels good, you know. Stayed 3 weeks in the psychiatric ward, got out, went back to the way I was drinking before I went in there. That's the insanity of this disease. Forgot that alcohol locked me up in a psychiatric ward to begin with. Completely blacked that out of my mind, you know. Went back drinking, back to the same old stories, drinking for any excuse under the sun, made up excuses, you know, had a job, lost a job, girlfriend, no girlfriend. It didn't matter. It was an excuse to drink, you know. When I came to America, actually, shortly after I got here, my mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. I was so wrapped up in my alcoholism and my selfishness and self-centeredness that my ego and my selfishness would not allow me to go back to Ireland to see my dying mother. And I used that excuse for 3 years. That she was going to die, so now I have an excuse to drink. And I used that for 3 years. 3 years she lived after I got word that she had ovarian cancer. And not once did I even attempt to go back and see her. Because all I cared about was alcohol. Didn't care about you. Didn't care about me. Didn't care about my dying mother. As long as I was drinking, the world was okay and life was good. And that's all that mattered in my life. So I used that excuse for 3 years. You know, this is a woman I supposedly love, and I can't show it. Because the tools I was given as a kid said, real men don't cry, they don't show their emotions, and God forbid you should tell someone that you love them, especially a family member. You know, that would never happen in my household. Never. You know. Eventually I got the word that she's almost on her last days. I go back, and I'm there probably 2 weeks before she finally passes away. Now, my family, I got 2 brothers, 3 sisters, and my father. They go to work in the morning. My father would go to see my mother before he went to work in the morning, come home, take care of his other sons and daughters, and go back up to the hospital that night. I come home, the prodigal son, I got nothing to do except show up. And I can't even go to the hospital because I want to drink. My disease tells me go drink. I need to go back down to the gin mill, say hello to all the boys, and catch up in the good times. And I use the excuse that I can't go see my mother, and I say to myself, that's not the woman I left 3 years ago. And that's the excuse I use. And it worked. And I would go, I would leave my house, go down, light the fire in the gin mill, sit there, until one of two things happened. Until the body gave in, or I ran out of money that day. You know? And that's my path of drinking. This is my journey. This is how I got to the top of the mountain. There are many paths to the top of the mountain. Your path doesn't have to be the same as my path. But when you get to the top of the mountain, the view is always the same. You know? And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. It has changed my outlook on life. It's given me a new set of attitudes, new set of emotions, and a new set of ideas. A God of my understanding, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you people in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous have changed my thinking. You know, that household that I used to grow up in, we had white elephants in the living room, and we walked around them thinking they'd go away. Because of this program, those white elephants are gone. My brothers and sisters, we talk to one another about problems in our lives now. That never happened before. Not least, it might have happened when I was drinking. They never taught me about it, you know. But the miracle of the program is they come to me for information now. I'm the second youngest of six. They come to me for information. This is a guy who left school at 14 and learned the facts of life picking potatoes. My brothers and sisters all finished school. I ran out of school because I had a fear of failing. They come to me for information. And the information I give them, I got from you people. You people have made me what I am today. If I sound intelligent, it's because of you people. And if I screw this up, it's because of you people. Oh, sorry. AA. There's a friend of ours, Tom Im in Long Beach. He says you can live two lifetimes in one. You know, I came in here when I was 25 with the mentality I just told you. You know, I stand here before you, 40 years old, a husband, a father, a worker, a friend, and it's because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I show up to work. I'm there to do a day's work. That's my job. Most days. Every now and again, I try to control it, but I get smacked and I get put back in my place, you know. I learned today how to be a husband in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to be a father in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, ironically, my wife, I know my wife 9 years, and she's the first woman that I have dated that I haven't cheated on. First woman I've dated I haven't cheated on. If I come back to this meeting, that might change. But that's because of the rumors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can show up today, you know. I didn't want to, all I wanted to do when I came to AA was for you people to show me how to drink like I was when I was 18, 19 years of age and get a good night's sleep. That's all I wanted. That's all I wanted. You know, show me how I drank when I was 18 and 19. Because those were the good times in my life and that's what I wanted back. Those good times are long gone, you know. I have gotten a lot more than a good night's sleep out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if I can ever repay it back, to be honest with you. But all I can do is try. I go to a meeting, I see a newcomer, I get introduced to somebody new. I pass on to them what you people have given to me. And I don't look for any reward for it. God decides who gets the rewards and in what shape they're going to come in. That's God's job. My job is to show up. You know, sponsees will tell you that you've helped them. Sponsees helped me more than I've helped them. And that's how it works. That's how it works. I have a God in my life today that is not the God I grew up with. I grew up with a God that's hellfire and brimstone. When I was a kid in the church back home, the priest stood in the altar, church bigger than this one. And he looked down and he looked right at me and he told me, if you do wrong, if you think wrong, you're going to hell. And that's what I believed. So at 6 or 7 years of age, I had evil thoughts. Don't ask me what they were. I had them. So I figured I was going to hell. And then if you weren't going to hell, they were going to put you in purgatory. That's the God I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with. Hellfire and brimstone. Now, you people reintroduce me to a completely different God. Loving, caring, forgiving, understanding God. You know, I left school when I was 14 for fear of failing. I have gone back and taken classes. I've taken exams because God has helped me. I ask God to guide me. He guides me. I ask you people to show me the way, and you show me the way. Because I come to meetings and I hear how you people go through life on life's terms without picking up a drink one day at a time. It's in here I learned to live life on life's terms. I thought I was getting an education on the barstool. This is the greatest education I've ever gotten in my life. And it's from a bunch of drunks who have gotten their life and who have changed their way. Because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a new set of emotions, a new set of attitudes, and a new set of ideas that helped me to be a husband, to be a father, to be a friend, and to ask for help and guidance when I need it. That's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous gives me. And I don't know if I can give it back. I don't know if I can repay it. But I can only try. And that's all it's asked of me. And all I got to do is ask God in the morning to help me stay sober. And all I have to do at night is thank Him. And when I get jammed up, all I got to do is stop, pause when hesitated or aggravated, and ask Him for guidance. I try my best to live in steps 10, 11, and 12 today. You know, when my character defects flare up, I ask God to remove them and I talk to somebody else. And it works. And that's how it works. You know, but I got to put in the footwork. I got to come in here. I got to ask for help. I got to put pen to paper and clean house, share it with another alcoholic, ask God to remove it in 6 and 7, make a list in 8, go out, make amends in 9, and live in 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. And I don't pick up one drink one day at a time. I haven't seen rats or snakes or the devil coming out the wall in a lot of years. Thank God. They're still there. Every now and again I hear them crawling. They raise their ugly heads once in a great while. But they go away. If you're new of coming back, this is the easier, softer way. You might think the work is difficult, but the rewards are much, much greater. Trust me. Believe me. If you don't believe me, believe any one of these people here tonight, and they'll tell you the same thing. Thank you very much.